A global campaign has been launched by humanitarian activists calling for a lifting of the blockade on Sana'a International Airport. The airport was forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition shortly after its invasion on Yemen in 2015. The signing of a ceasefire agreement deal with the Saudi-led coalition last year was supposed to alleviate the suffering of the Yemeni patients. But in effect, nothing has changed for those in need of medical treatment.
According to reports, nearly 8,000 sick Yemenis have passed away during the ceasefire because they were not able to fly out of the country in time to get proper medical treatment. Medical health officials are calling the closure of Sana'a Airport a grave public health tragedy.
And that's because more sick Yemenis will continue to die if they are unable to fly out for life-saving medical treatment.
We launched this campaign with both Yemeni and non-Yemeni activists to make it clear that Sana'a Airport remains besieged. Only three flights consisting of 700 passengers are allowed a week. Before the aggression, that number was 6,000 passengers a week. There are many sick patients who need to fly out of the country for immediate medical treatment. Currently, there are 30,000 sick patients unable to fly out of the country because of this blockade.
The campaign to open Sana'a Airport has attracted much support from human rights and anti-war activists worldwide, demanding an end to the blockade.
From Canada, we join our voice to people in Yemen and all over the world that are condemning and denouncing the continued U.S.-Saudi Emirati aggression and blockade against the people of Yemen. The U.S.-backed, Saudi-led bombing campaign and war on Yemen for over 8 years have destroyed hospitals, healthcare infrastructure. Thousands today in Yemen cannot access medical care. Thousands are waiting to be able to travel outside of Yemen to access that medical care.
Today, Yemen needs to rebuild. Yemen needs access to health care. For that, this blockade needs to be lifted immediately. The land, air, and sea blockade needs to be lifted so that the people of Yemen can have access to medical supplies and supplies needed to rebuild their country.
According to reports, an estimated 120,000 Yemenis have died as a direct result of the closure of Sana'a Airport. Many of those patients are dialysis patients who were not able to get the kidney transplants available only abroad. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Boasting the highlights of his presidency, in the third press conference held during his tenure, President Ebrahim Raisi put the spotlight on successful efforts made over the past 2 years to expand foreign relations, pointing out that enemies have failed to isolate Iran and drive the nation into despair. The Iranian president stressed that Tehran has managed to forge strong relations with Islamic and like-minded countries.
We've expanded our foreign ties and improved the level of political and economic relations. Our commercial ties have grown 14% compared to the previous government. These achievements have been made while the enemy has tried to follow two strategies of isolating Iran in the world and disappointing the people inside the country, which it failed in both.
President Raisi's administration has been following numerous agendas in Iran foreign policy, the most important of which is the JCPOA and the removal of sanctions. But at the same time, Tehran has also been able to gain a foothold in the political equations in the region and beyond by obtaining memberships in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS.
Alliances like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and BRICS are definitely effective against U.S. unilateralism. Our membership in these organizations shows that the enemy did not succeed in his policy to isolate Iran, and our political, commercial, and economic situation shows that the enemy has failed in this strategy.
But the highlight of the administration's efforts is the stronger relations it has forged with regional countries and the resumption of ties with Saudi Arabia in particular.
Iran has made great achievements as far as foreign policy is concerned, and according to the president, it will be taking more steps to expand its foreign relations. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
market and consumer protection. And
it has been named Digital Services Act, or DSA, and it is the European Union new law designed to tackle hate speech and fake news online. But it is much more than that. The DSA, which came into effect on August 25, stipulates that online platforms with more than 45 million monthly active users will have to take off illegal content, hate speech, and so-called disinformation from their platforms, or they will face fines of up to 6% of their annual global turnover.
As it occurs for many other EU laws, the DSA's real objectives seem to be hidden. While it is clear that the risk the EU could abuse this mechanism is worrying indeed. My concern is that people's rights that have been so far protected by our constitution may be circumvented by lackluster provisions.
More than 40 online giants, including Google, Facebook, Twitter and YouTube, must now comply with the new legislation which will force them to be legally accountable for everything from fake news to manipulation of shoppers, government propaganda and criminal activity, including child abuse. But a question remains open. Who decides what counts as real or fake news? And who decides what is and is not disinformation?
This is the real issue. Who decides what disinformation is? According to the ACT, this decision will be made arbitrarily by some EU officials with the help of trusted flaggers, bodies of people entitled to tip the authorities off. Which bodies? Which people? In my view, this whole legislation was designed to contain growing dissent in the EU.
Many in Italy, including some political organizations, newspapers and individuals, have expressed deep concerns over the DSA. Even the head of the League's delegation to the EU Parliament, Marco Campomenosi, has warned the DSA is likely to strengthen censorship on the internet. The League is one of Italy's coalition government parties. On the heels of the DSA, also a new European Digital Markets Act has recently come into effect. The provision is designed to regulate competition between large and smaller companies. Tech giants, for instance, will no longer be allowed to rank their own products or services higher than those of their competitors for the sake of consumers or end users, the EU says. The regulation of the Digital Services Act will be overseen by the European Commission itself, not by an independent regulator. The implications for freedom of expression are obvious and ominous. Max Civili, Rome.
On August 29, 2021, as the US was withdrawing its forces tumultuously, their drones were flying over Kabul to maintain security. A car suspected of carrying bombs was placed under surveillance. After a tiring day, Zomeray, the owner of the car, returned home to find peace with his family. As he parked the car in the yard and his children rushed to greet him, the man behind the joystick and his superiors made the fateful decision that this was the best time to act.
Zomeray and nine members of his family were tragically killed in the airstrike carried out by American forces on that day. Seven of the victims were innocent children under the age of 12. The youngest was only 2 years old. Zomeray himself was a relief worker who had spent the last day of his life distributing food among needy people in Kabul.
During the US withdrawal, which took almost 2 weeks, Afghan people witnessed countless brutalities and painful events. Ruhullah and Ahmad say that the bitter memories of those days will remain with them forever, etched in their minds as a reminder of the suffering they endured.
I remember the chaos those days. The explosion near the airport and the drone attack on that car were heartbreaking. This is what we saw during the entire presence of the U.S. here. Death and destruction, but no benefit.
The innocent children that did not know anything about policy, didn't know anything about government, didn't know anything about life, but they are being killed, and it's really mournful for me and also for all citizens of Afghanistan.
Back the fuck up!
During the 15-day pullout of U.S. forces, many people were killed either directly by the Americans or indirectly through their negligence. Some by falling off American planes, many in a suicide attack near the Kabul airport, and some by American missiles inside their own home. Most experts believe that the U.S. is to blame for these lost lives.
As the U.S. was withdrawn, they intentionally made a false announcement claiming that they would take as many Afghans abroad as possible. This caused many people to rush to the airport in hopes of being taken to safety. The U.S. had several motives for this action, but the most important one was to show the world that the people of Afghanistan wanted them here in an attempt to justify their 20-year presence in the country. However, chaos quickly spiraled out of control, resulting in the tragic loss of many lives.
A day after the airstrike, the Pentagon spokesperson said that the civilians were probably killed by a second explosion, but experts proved that there was only one explosion from the missile. American authorities simply got over with the case by saying it was a mistake and that they were sorry, yet no one was fired or even demoted. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
On August 30, 1981, a briefcase bomb exploded in the office of Mohammad Javad Bahonar, then Prime Minister of Iran, which killed him and then President Mohammad Ali Rajoi, along with six other government officials, as the entire first floor of the Prime Minister's office was destroyed. Rajoi and Bahonar had won the elections in a landslide victory, receiving an overwhelming 91% of the ballots. Hundreds of thousands of Iranians attended the funeral, marking yet another deadly attack carried out by the terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, who has the blood of 17,000 Iranians on its hands. The tragic event has ever since been marked as Government Week on the Iranian calendar. And today, the empty seat of Shahid Rajoi graces an exhibition set up to mark the occasion, showcasing the achievements of President Ebrahim Raisi's administration.
The Raisi administration has made great achievements over the past 2 years. In foreign policy, for example, you can see that our country has become a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and just a few days ago, BRICS announced that it will be accepting Iran as a full member. We have also resumed diplomatic relations with countries such as Saudi Arabia. These are very important steps taken by the government.
As far as domestic policy is concerned, issues particularly pertaining to women and families have been high on the agenda.
Social security, healthcare, and retirement plans are now in place for stay-at-home moms, particularly those living in small cities and villages. Mothers with more than three kids have been prioritized. This is all in line with the policy to provide support for families. Also, the budget we needed has been allocated to small business loans for women who are the sole providers of their families and want to start a business.
But it's not just women who are receiving government support. Knowledge-based companies have also been on the list, many of them active in agriculture, industry, and healthcare sectors.
We specialize in manufacturing industrial flow meters. We have recently produced a highly accurate ultrasonic flow meter, and the Ministry of Energy can use it in various infrastructural projects.
Iran's public and private sectors have joined hands for the country to prosper, and the exhibition held on the occasion of Government Week this year clearly reflects that.
Over the past decades, Iran has taken major steps towards sustainable development, despite Western pressure and unilateral sanctions. And now this occasion is an opportunity for the entire nation to look forward to a brighter future. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
Amid widespread anger over the disturbing trend of Quran desecrations across Scandinavia, the Danish government has announced plans to criminalize public mistreatment of religious objects. The new laws would permit police to act if holy scriptures, including the Quran, the Bible, or the Torah, are physically violated.
The Danish authorities' promise to change the law has been well received by many Muslim onlookers. However, there is still a lot of concern surrounding the reasons behind why this decision may be implemented. The idea that Denmark is facing a major threat from the Muslim world, rather than, for example, admitting that their freedom of speech argument is flawed, that is in itself suspect and could even be an indication or a message to the Muslim world that Denmark is not willing to adopt any responsibility for the vile desecrations and offence that have been caused. Rather, they're seeking to place blame once again on the Muslim community itself for the reasons behind this law change.
On Saturday, local Danish Muslims gathered in a show of strength to continue the pressure in hopes of the law change proposal becoming a reality. Danish coalition officials said they could enact the policy as soon as the end of the year if it is approved by Parliament. According to a draft of a bill published by the Danish Justice Ministry, those found guilty of mistreating an object with major religious significance could be fined or sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. Both Denmark and neighbouring Sweden have struggled to defend the West's free speech argument, finally wilting in the face of international condemnations. The Quran desecrations infuriated the Muslim world, sparking massive protests across the globe. Rather than owning up or apologising for their defence of hate speech, Denmark's leaders have said that the national security was the primary motivation for the ban. This was the excuse they've used for the law change. While some Muslims have been left disappointed with this reasoning, some celebrate the development as a victory in the war against Islamophobic hate speech. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
The Limelight.
In Britain, new research has shown that many people are currently facing worsening and in some cases catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays in healthcare. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A damning report warned thousands of patients in England are experiencing catastrophic health impact as a result of vital NHS appointments, procedures or operations being delayed or cancelled. A record 7.5 million people are waiting to start routine hospital treatment, the highest figure since records began back in 2007. About 385,000 people have now been waiting more than a year to start their NHS treatment. A devastating report by Healthwatch England, a watchdog, says the last-minute cancellations were causing patients to get even sicker and their mental health to deteriorate. It found some in severe pain have endured multiple cancellations and postponements. In 2022-2023, there were 77,266 last-minute cancelled operations for people waiting for pre-planned care in hospitals in England. Meanwhile, separate figures show that strikes over the past 8 months have led to 819,000 appointments, operations and procedures being postponed. The report published on Thursday, 27th of July, came a day after junior doctors in England announced a fresh round of strikes in August, which could lead to tens of thousands of more treatments being either delayed or cancelled. The British Medical Association, the BMA, said junior doctors in England would stage a 4-day strike amid the continuing row with the government over pay, Thousands of new doctors will be urged to strike just over a week after starting work in England's hospitals. The strike will begin at 7 a.m. local time on 11th of August. A survey for the Health Watch report found that more than a third, or 39% of people who had an appointment called off this year, experienced cancellations or postponements two or more times. Approximately 1,084 adults in England who had an appointment cancelled in 2023 were polled by Yonder Data Solutions on behalf of Health Watch. They included people who faced postponements for pre-planned hospital care, hospital outpatient appointments, diagnosis scans or tests, and community health appointments. Nearly 1 in 5 or 18% said their appointments were cancelled at the last minute, either on the day or as they arrive for their appointment. About 66% said cancellations to care had an impact, reporting continuing pain, worsening symptoms, worsening mental health, and disrupted sleep, among other problems. Half, or 52%, said they had not been offered support to manage their medical condition during the new wait for care, and 79% said the National Health Service had offered them very little or no support with their mental health. Health Watch said some groups appeared to be disproportionately affected by the cancellations. They include unpaid carers, neurodivergent people, those on lower incomes, and people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Louise Ansari, the chief executive of Health Watch England, said the findings of our research show that many people are currently facing worsening and, in some cases, catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays to care. Louise Ansari continued, and addressing health inequalities continues to be a significant challenge for the National Health Service. She added, people who often face serious difficulties accessing specialist NHS care, such as unpaid carers, neurodivergent people and those on lower incomes, are also those who are suffering the most from ongoing cancellations. She added, if their symptoms worsen or their mental health deteriorates, this in turn puts extra pressure on health and care services. We urgently need to reduce the number of cancellations of appointments, especially last-minute cancellations, and greater action is needed to address widening health inequalities. She added, with industrial action in the National Health Service being one of the many factors impacting people's ability to access timely health care, we're also renewing our call for all parties to reach a resolution to mitigate the impact of strikes on patients. An NHS England spokesperson said strikes over the past 8 months had obviously had a significant impact, but claimed that staff were doing all they could to manage the disruption. National broadcaster ITV has also covered the same story. Radiographers at 37 National Health Service trusts in England are going on strike as the pay row with the government continues. Members of the Society of Radiographers have voted to reject the government's 5% pay award and called for talks to reopen after other public sector workers, including junior doctors, were offered more. The union said worrying numbers of staff are leaving the profession and not enough is being done to recruit more workers. The 48-hour strike will run from 8 a.m. local time on Tuesday, 1st of August, and will involve the 35 NHS trusts where members have a mandate to strike. These include the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital in London, University College London Hospitals, Liverpool University Hospitals, Nottingham University Hospitals, University Hospitals, Bristol and Western, and Sheffield's Teaching Hospitals. The Society of Radiographers said 9 out of 10 NHS patients are supported by radiographers who carry out X-rays, magnetic resonance imaging and CT scans, ultrasounds and breast screening, as well as radiotherapy for cancer patients. 1 million people are waiting for radiography. Dean Rogers, Executive Director of Industrial Strategy and Member Relations for the Society of Radiographers, said, "Voting for strike action was a difficult decision for our members, who care above all about the safety and well-being of their patients." Dean Rogers added, "We need to draw attention to the fact that many radiography professionals are feeling burnt out by low pay and increased working hours. They're leaving the National Health Service and they're not being replaced in adequate numbers." Dean Rogers added, "If the government wants to reduce NHS waiting lists and ensure that patients receive the treatment that they need when they need it, then it must urgently prioritise the recruitment and retention of radiography professionals. And that means talking to us about our pay and conditions." He said, "But they're refusing to talk to us even though our door is open. Our members deserve better. Our patients deserve better." Health and Social Care Secretary Steve Barclay said, "I want to see an end to disruptive strikes so the National Health Service can focus relentlessly on cutting waiting lists and delivering for patients." Dr. Win Diwakar, the National Health Service Medical Director for Secondary Care, said, "Figures show that impact of industrial action is having on patients and families, and the scale of disruption is likely to be even greater, with many services avoiding scheduling appointments for the strike days." Dr. Vin Diwakar said, "We have now seen 765,000 appointments needing to be rescheduled in the last 8 months because of strikes, and we are continuing to see a significant cumulative impact on National Health Service services, as well as our hardworking staff, as they do all they can to maintain safe patient services while tackling a record backlog."
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The United States concluded its occupation of Afghanistan on August 30th, 2021, although many are still calling it a military engagement. Now the second anniversary of that missing withdrawal is here. The Biden administration has been slammed for the way it withdrew from that country. Even after 20 years of occupation, it couldn't get its departure right. Why the U.S. failed so miserably in Afghanistan despite having the military hardware and the assistance of its NATO allies is the topic of this edition of the program. First, let me introduce our guest. Don DeBar, activist and commentator, joins us from Ossining, New York. Also joining us, Esha Krishnaswamy, who's a podcaster and journalist who joins us from Madison, Connecticut. Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first over to you. So we have the anniversary of the 2 year since the U.S. occupation forces departed Afghanistan after a 20-year conflict. Why do you think the way that the U.S. departed, and I know this has been played out, but still we need to try to dissect it as to why the departure ended up being the way that it was?
I mean, it's speculation from here, of course, even with the benefit of hindsight. They were in there for 20 years on the post-9, you know, 2 months shy of 20 years on the post-9/11 excuse. This is where the terrorists that struck at the heart of our democracy have been hiding, and we're going to go get them in the caves of Afghanistan, etc. It was a lie then. Everyone that was saying it out of their mouths in Washington knew it. But also, the U.S. had been in Afghanistan since Jimmy Carter was president. You know, before the Soviet Union came into Afghanistan, the U.S. was there, and that was one of the reasons that the Soviet Union came in, because the elected government in Kabul was threatened by warlords that the U.S. CIA organized, had armed and trained, that ended up becoming first the Mujahideen and then Al-Qaeda, the same group that blew up New York and the Pentagon and whatever else they hit that day. The escape from Afghanistan, or the transfer of the resources that they brought with them, including the, you know, the troops, that they've been redeployed, obviously, at this point to Ukraine. I don't know if that was the plan at the time, but the hasty retreat that they beat looked just like the one out of Saigon in 1974, 1975, I don't remember. It's the same scenario we have now. There's a long narrative that explains why they're there and how the war is going. That is a complete fabrication. It's made for the benefit of people in the United States, for the political benefit of the people, you know, who are holding office or in part of the political class that are going to be in power. And at the end of it, the condition is so far removed, there's such a huge vector between the reality of things when they're leaving and the narrative, that it looks and creates, like, it looks dissonant, and it creates dissonance in, you know, in the minds of the people looking at it, but it makes perfect sense. Afghanistan resisted from the beginning the U.S. invasion and occupation. There were not Afghan Democrats in waiting that were going to put flowers in the guns of the Americans when they arrived, any more than they were in Iraq or Vietnam, for that matter.
Sure,
the
sure.
U.S. is an imperial power. It was trying to exercise its dominion over Afghanistan. And the people of Afghanistan, as they've done for 1,000 years, resisted. And at the end of the day, the retreat that they had was the only one that was available to them. It was get out of town before sundown, basically.
Well, Esha, the way that the Taliban came to power, in terms of the speed at which they came into power, can only fall into two categories. Either the Afghan forces were so inadequately prepared to counter any type of, I guess if you want to call it, insurgency or attack, and many of that is blamed on the U.S. forces, that they were not able to actually train them properly. Of course, then they say the Afghans did not were not that quick in learning how to, I guess, be trained militarily. Or that there was no resistance because they wanted the Taliban to actually come to power, because they were sick and tired of what happened after the 20-year occupation. What do you think? Which one do you think it is?
It is both, because what people don't realize is that right after, in 1992, right after the Soviets, right after the Soviets left, there was a big civil war in Afghanistan where you had a bunch of warlords who were warring each other. And what people don't realize is that these many of these warlords were actually, like, raping children. And in one of the famous stories, the way the Taliban came into power is basically by hanging one of these warlords who was, like, was gang raping everyone in town. And actually, that's how they came into power in 1996. But then what happened in 2001 was that basically the Bush White House through people like Hamid Karzai and all other warlords, decided the Afghanistan constitution in this Bonn conference, where they just was a, it was a wheeling and dealing between various warlords, and people's lives were miserable. In fact, I saw a video, I put this up on my YouTube channel, where in 2007 they interviewed people, and people were actually getting nostalgia from the Taliban. But then what happened is that the Taliban changed their strategy too. In 1996, they were mainly an ethnic Pashtun group. But within the next 20 years, what happened is that the government of that was extremely corrupt, that had just horrible warlords, people who were like Ashraf Ghani fled Afghanistan with $64 million in his plane. They were able to get other ethnicities like the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, the Daris, and so later the coalition became stronger. And then towards the end, the government failed so much and there was so much corruption that the Afghan troops were not even equipped with basics like shoes and food. And so for many, it just made sense to just turn their backs and run. And it's all because, of course, we know that the U.S. never really wanted to fight terrorism or install whatever version of democracy. Instead, they wanted to put people who they can trust in order to extract resources. And there was a huge resource extraction from Afghanistan over the course of 20 years.
All right. So many things went wrong in that war. I mean, we could talk about it. I'm wondering where to go with what our guest, Arisha, said, Don DeBar. I think she touched on something that perhaps I need to ask from you. And when it comes to this whole notion of democracy that the U.S. wanted to prevail in that country, because they wanted to basically create it from what many accounts have said, from scratch. I mean, a model modeled after their own in Washington. What do you think about the fact that they had aspirations to do so? Obviously, I'm guessing, for one, it showed the disconnect they had from the reality on the ground in terms of the culture of Afghans. But, of course, your opinion matters here.
Well, first of all, the people of Afghanistan themselves are as capable as anyone on the planet of having a democracy, maybe not the kind that the U.S. calls democracy, but maybe something actually more democratic. So there's nothing intrinsic, first of all, to the people of Afghanistan that is hostile to the idea of, you know, ruling themselves in a fair and equitable way. The U.S. effort there obviously is contrary to any notion of that. It was an occupation that lasted, manifestation of it lasted 20 years. There's some similarities, though, between what happened in Afghanistan while the occupation took place and what happened, say, in Southeast Asia while the occupation took place, and what happened for the last 60 years, say, in Colombia while the occupation took place, and in some other places, too. And the commonality being massive drug dealing of, in the case of Afghanistan and Vietnam, opium and poppies and heroin and all the products of that, and in Latin America, cocaine. The CIA has been caught both arranging and dealing cocaine, including to the American public, in communities across the United States. We had a crack epidemic that was laid at the feet of the CIA for the dealings that they were doing in Latin America in order to fund illegal wars there. We had a massive upsurge in heroin deaths and all of the ancillary things that go with heroin addiction in the United States following 2001, like we had in the United States following 1979. So, you know, that's no accident. And in the late 60s and early 70s, in my high school, there was an epidemic of heroin that ran through it. These are people that came back from Vietnam. This is not a coincidence. These things are directly related to the way the United States occupies these countries and exploits their resources.
This notion has been obviously talked about and thrown out there, Isha, quite a bit in terms of the opium production in Afghanistan and the U.S. collusion. Do you have a point that you'd like to make?
A few months ago, there was an article written by, I think it was a British source, where they basically, it was something like the Taliban ended the opium production, but is it too soon? Or something like that, where they were trying to argue that that was a bad thing. But if you look at the statistics, it is very clear. Until about after 1992 to 1996, the opium production of Afghanistan was going up. And then between 1996 and 2001, it went down. And between 2001 and 2021, it went up, and then suddenly it went way down. And this is publicly available. It's also available on my, I've tweeted about this. But it is clear that there is a connection between these warlords that the U.S. installed and the amount of opium that was produced in Afghanistan. And in many of these areas, they produced so much opium that Afghanistan was not able to be food sovereign in order to grow food for their own people. And that is why right now they're still having problems with foods and having adequate food. And they are, oh, let's not forget that they are currently under sanctions by the U.S., despite the fact that the U.S. has done everything possible to make the quality of life for the people in Afghanistan as worse as possible. And one comment is that in 1979, I read a memo from the State Department where they basically said that the Afghanistan Democratic Government was doing the best for the people, but the U.S. had to go and arm these mujahideens just to send a message to the third world what the cost of resisting imperialism is. And this is a public memo from the State Department. So that shows you how intentionally Afghanistan was targeted for immiseration by the U.S., and they are still going to be feeling the consequences of this for a very long time.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
This question is to you, Don DeBar. Did a quick search on the opium production and the U.S. Involvement, and one of the first entries that I came up with supports what Esha there, Don DeBar, said. I'm going to read off what this says, and this comes from a person who is a medical advisor who said the simple facts are that opium production was high under the U.S.-influenced government of Afghanistan of the 70s, decreased tenfold by 2001 under the Taliban, and then increased 30-fold and more under the U.S. to the same level as in the 1970s. The notion of warlords has been thrown about, Don DeBar, and there was a study that was done, the relationship between the U.S. and the warlords of how the U.S. was actually funding it. Back in the year 2010, this report came out, to the tune of $2.1 billion in order for the U.S. to use them for security purposes because, well, the country obviously was not very stable. You know, when you hear a report like that, this wasn't done directly, by the way, but indirectly it was ending up in their pockets. What does that say about just the U.S. strategy, that it really lacked logic when it went and did things like this? Because they were fighting them. Were they not fighting the warlords, and then they're indirectly funding them?
And making money with them. The objectives of the United States in Afghanistan were pretty clearly stated by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the architect of the U.S. policy under the Carter administration at that time in 1976, 1977. Carter took office in 1977. And that was to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. And by that, he meant a brushfire war that you couldn't put the brushfire out, that would consume resources and create contradictions at home. This was the reason that Afghanistan was lit on fire. It was admitted to by the guy with the match, okay? The modality that they used and the metaphor that he invoked actually is perfectly apt, because the mechanism that they employed in Afghanistan was the same one that they employed in Southeast Asia, including with warlords who were also big drug dealers, cartel leaders, as they call them in Latin America. In Thailand, there were warlords that were involved in the drug trade in the Golden Triangle there, and in Vietnam, in Laos, and Cambodia. It's worth noting that at the time that this happened, major drug dealing in the United States was a capital offense. If you were caught masterminding a scheme like took place pretty much in the open and dragged into court and put in front of a jury and then a judge passed sentence out of the book, you would be executed, or you'd stand a very real chance of that. None of these ever were even prosecuted because of the way that these things were handled. But the fingerprints of these people are clearly on it. Again, Brzezinski said, we're going to use Afghanistan to take, you know, to damage the Soviet Union. It brought the USSR into the place. It destroyed the central government that was based in Kabul. It set the warlords loose on the people in the countryside. And from there flourished the trade until the Taliban came to power. And then again, when the United States had their hand in it, from 2001 forward, you had another flourishing of this business. They used the profits, as we've seen with Iran-Contra and other examples, to fund illegal aspects of the war and all kinds of illegal operations that the CIA runs.
Sure. Well, this
may I make a quick comment?
Sure,
go
ahead.
I want to read an excerpt from a 2010 U.S. congressional report. Security for the U.S. supply chain is principally provided by warlords. The principal private security subcontractors on the H&D contracts are warlords, strongmen, commanders, and militia leaders who compete with the Afghanistan central government for power and authority. Providing protection services for the U.S. supply chain empowers these warlords with money, legitimacy, and a raison d'etre for their private armies. And this is from a 2010 U.S. congressional report.
Excellent. That's a good point made there. In order to tackle some of the other fiascos, for lack of a better word, that was committed in that country, Esha, I'm wondering this whole notion of nation building. If I don't know if you remember, it was stoned quite a bit by the generals and the U.S. administration, whether it was Obama, mostly Obama, really, and some of his generals. Why would the U.S. think that they can do that? If you recall, I think it was Flynn who said, we need to win the hearts and minds as part of this nation building, which never happened. They couldn't do it in countries like Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Haiti, or Somalia. Why did they think they could do it in Afghanistan?
Of course they don't think they can do it, because what the U.S. has done is they have not built schools. For example, when the Sandinistas came into power in Nicaragua, they eradicated illiteracy in 5 months. When you look at Helmand province in Afghanistan, after 20 years, the female literacy rate was 1%, while 99% was illiterate. So they've impoverished everyone. They've tied people, a lot of the farmers into weird patent deals with Monsanto. So there is no way they can win the hearts and minds. And if they could win the hearts and minds, they would not need to go and have violent war. So that is just a pretense, because their economic model is just not commiserate with winning the hearts and minds, because they do not do anything to make the lives of the people of these countries better. It is just a way to assuage the American public from showing resistance for these extravagant resource extraction campaigns that are extraordinary and violent.
All right, let's fast forward now to what we're looking at today, Don DeBar. One of the most interesting things that we have seen happen, at least in one perspective, is the fact that you have the Taliban that came into power. But we're seeing a somewhat, not, I don't want to say a rise, but we're seeing these sporadic presence of al-Qaeda in that country. Now, there are some that are of the belief that al-Qaeda in Syria and in Iraq have been shuffled out of those countries, and they have been repositioned inside of Afghanistan. They've even said that the U.S. may be involved in this. But we are seeing their presence there. We don't see much of a reaction coming from the U.S. on this issue, or even other Western countries. What kind of landscape are we looking at in that regard?
Some of this stuff is secret, and so it's a secret to us too. But by deduction, the U.S. was basically driven out of town 2 years ago today, and they want to be back in. The geostrategic value of Afghanistan remains, both the, in terms of the geography, and also just in terms of the general positioning in the political environment in that part of the country, of that part of the world. So it makes perfect sense that even though they've been completely discredited, even though essentially the whole country has been mobilized against them, they are angling these. I'm talking about the people that make policy here that, you know, destroyed Afghanistan over a 44-year period or 45-year period, whatever it is, trying to get back in and give it another dose. I think it's a hard way for them to go. I don't think there's very much you're going to find patience among the Afghan population for any of the U.S. shenanigans. I think that no matter what label terrorist group they run through there to try to allow some positioning. I mean, again, you know, we had the construction of, you know, the proto-Al-Qaeda by U.S. CIA in Afghanistan that essentially destroyed the countryside and set the country on fire for the whole time since 1977 until now. I don't think the population is going to willingly go follow another group like that until they know exactly what the hell they're doing, who these people are, who's behind them, and where they intend to take the country. And I think at the moment, they're satisfied with the Taliban.
Yeah, well, we're still looking at the fact that you have the Taliban, Esha, there, and you have the presence of Al-Qaeda there. And for the U.S., that doesn't seem to be that bad of a deal, given the fact that it wouldn't mind, in one form or another, to use perhaps those two when it comes to, let's say, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is to the left, or to have a launch pad for other countries that maybe the U.S. wants to use these forces there to target. Do you think that this may be the thinking that the U.S. has?
When you have...
Well, of course.
I'm sorry, Don DeBar. This is for Esha. Go ahead. Esha, go ahead.
Of course. Another thing people should realize is that Xinjiang, China, is not that far. And that is kind of very central to the China's Belt and Road Initiative. So having Al-Qaeda and even ISIS-K strategically placed there is one of their best strategies in order to sabotage any progress with the Belt and Road Initiative. And we know that how often Iran faces terrorist attacks from Al-Qaeda members, especially towards the east, that it is obvious that they often use it in order to create terror and chaos with countries that they consider to be enemy countries. So of course, for the US, it is useful. And a variation of ISIS in Afghanistan and the ISIS-K, it has a very strange history that we really need to investigate, because it just doesn't make sense without some kind of extraordinary foreign involvement, and we need to figure out who this is and what their purpose is.
All right, Don DeBoer, you wanted to say something in closing.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So when I was referring to the geostrategic value of it, of course, I'm talking particularly in relation to, you know, the position to thwart or somehow impact the Belt Road Initiative. I spent a few weeks in Western China and Central China this past summer, Urumqi and Dunhuang and Jian, and particularly in Urumqi, we met. First of all, there's lots of Muslims. There's big Muslim quarters in the cities there, and they're predominant in a couple of the cities. And people there are from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, and I didn't know this, but the entire border there along there, traditionally going back, you know, 1,000 years or better, is porous. It's open. People freely go back and forth between these areas. From a national security perspective for China, this is very dangerous. When you have the United States arming every terrorist Islamic group that they could send out, you know, from the, of the